Hi, this is Roger Green, host of the Surfing the Mesh Tsunami podcast. This week, we are offering five conversations from episode 12, with Sven Franke and Will Alazawi joining Joran, Louise, and me to consider what failures have taught us about drug development, particularly after the success of the Resdiffra launch. Plus, from the vault, a conversation from last September about differences between how we would use NITs to evaluate patients for trials versus evaluate the efficacy of drugs in an individual patient. This conversation starts with Will Alazawi suggesting that the MASH clinical trial field suffers from the previous experience with hepatitis C, where medications became capable of eradicating disease in a fairly linear fashion. He suggests that MASH trials undervalue the value of simply preventing progression, which leads Sven Franke to note that preventing progression to cirrhosis is now accepted by regulators as an endpoint. I refer to our most recent episode, Season 5, Episode 11, in which Michael Charlton states that his efficacy criterion for continuing a patient on Resdiffra will be lack of progression, and I suggest that a clinically valuable efficacy measure must be applicable to true clinical practice. I go on to note Sven's comment that having NAS score as a co-endpoint complicates the challenge of proving efficacy because the scale is relatively blunt and not well-suited to the task at hand. Sven suggests that an activity score focused on inflammation and ballooning might function better than one that includes steatosis. Joran Schottenberg suggests this might be true, but will depend on the mode of action of the drug. Sven reminds the group of a paper Stephen Harris had presented at AASLD, suggesting the approach Sven describes, splitting NAS into separate steatosis and activity scores, with the activity score based on lobular inflammation and ballooning. I ask whether the widely reported challenges in coding ballooning as a nominal score will render this method less valuable. Sven agrees and notes that this challenge stems from the lack of detail in the scoring system, that a more detailed scoring system or linear assessment would work fine. Louise Campbell suggests that in addition to stabilizing MASH, endpoints might look at related metabolic diseases that poor liver health can affect. Will agrees, noting that many patients may be on other metabolic agents at the outset of a trial, or more challenging, the definition of good practice might change during the trial, which can add variability to the sample. He wonders whether differences in placebo rate can provide insight on this issue. I recall a comment from Dean Tai of Histo Index during Season 4, Episode 50.4, that some Histo Index AI-driven analyses produce consistent placebo rates of 33%, with efficacy levels much higher. Having an approved drug changes lots of things for the better, but not everything. This conversation considers some of the issues we've yet to resolve. So just sit back, listen, enjoy, learn. When you're done, join the dialogue in our LinkedIn discussion group.
William Alazawi.
I think your point about prevention of progression is real, and some of it actually might be where we started from. So the original point of understanding was about, if you like, I always think that this field was slightly hampered by the success of viral hepatitis that happened alongside us at the very beginning. We wanted to get rid of the injury. We had that mentality. We were a bit scared to say, or not a bit scared, but maybe a little overcautious to say, do you know what? I don't need my liver to look pretty. I just need it not to get any worse. And I agree. I think that prevention of progression piece is really important.
Sven Frank.
Yeah, in the clinical endpoint trials, the regulators now have accepted that preventing progression to cirrhosis is a clinical event. So prevention of progression to cirrhosis is a potential benefit.
Roger Green.
So, Will, I like the word applicability. One of the things that came up last week on this podcast when we were actually talking with Michael Charlton about how he's treating patients in his clinic right now, is he made the same comment, which is the definition of efficacy he's going to use is lack of progression, which makes sense. I think I understand why the agencies wouldn't be comfortable with that one, partly because the disease is kind of heterodox, right? I mean, you know, over time, some people will get worse and some people will get better if you do nothing. So it becomes hard to figure out exactly how to grade out stable disease. And one of the episodes I'm looking to do in the next few weeks is about how other diseases and how the way we think about other diseases might have affected the way that regulators think about this. And I always go to oncology at moments like that, where stable disease, simply maintaining stable disease is an okay thing. But usually if you can't regress disease, they're not interested. So that was my main thought about that one. Sven, I was also intrigued by the observation in the paper that having as a criterion improvement of the NASH score with stabilization of fibrosis might not be a good thing either. I think the suggestion was that the NASH score was had too many elements in it and they were insufficiently controllable to know exactly what you were getting.
Yeah. The NAFLD activity score, you mean? Yeah. Because it's, of course, a mixture of steatosis and the signs of inflammation and liver cell damage. And of course, the steatosis is relevant, but you can have modes of action where the steatosis, which is very dynamic, as we all know, if the improvement in NAFLD activity score is mainly driven by reduction in steatosis, it's not necessarily reflective of less activity of the disease. It's still an important one, but probably not by definition reflective of reduction of disease activity in terms of inflammation and damage. And it's mainly those two that drive fibrogenesis, not the steatosis per se. Although, of course, steatosis is also a sign that something is wrong.
Jörn Schattenberg.
I mean, this introduces the concept again that it also depends on the MOA, right? So we have drugs heavily working on the steatosis side through weight loss or even anti-steatotic drugs, and ones that are a little bit more neutral on the weight side and have a different ability to change the steatosis here. I think they produce different results. And that means if you consider that endpoint and you make it very sensitive to changes in steatosis, you might not see the improvement of fibrosis based on your MOA you might be looking for. So I think that's important to consider, actually the MOA of the drug.
And it's also, I think, interesting to note that Stephen presented at NASHTAG also an analysis now separating steatosis from ballooning and inflammation in the NASH CRN scoring system and the NAFLD activity score. So the concept is, which has been introduced already a long time ago in the SAF scoring system, separating steatosis from activity and defining activity only by ballooning and lobular inflammation. Now we are getting more data that this separation makes sense and that we should probably look at steatosis and activity then separately.
So Sven, if we looked at activity separately, what would that imply for the challenges that are widely reported around assessment of ballooning? Do you still handle it the same way? Or at that point, if you put more weight on activity, do you have to do a better job of handling ballooning than this kind of 0-1 where people don't agree particularly?
Yeah, absolutely. But that's the problem we're also struggling with, of course, is that you have very, let's say, rough scoring systems. I mean, if you have activity in the SAF scoring system, it's just a maximum of 4 points. So you have only 5 different scores to give with an equal weight for ballooning and lobular inflammation. If you take it from the NASH CRN, there's 1 point more for lobular inflammation. So it's a little bit more granular. But you're right, the challenge about the correct identification of ballooning and the quantification of both ballooning and lobular inflammation is a challenge. And I think there are machine learning approaches that really standardize the analysis of the biopsy can I think, really be helpful.
Louise Campbell.
But I wonder whether we are, within liver disease, being, I suppose, detrimental because we do have the only regenerative organ. So we're looking for that regeneration within the disease. No other disease has that opportunity. So it's about that progression. And I think it's been said here in the last few podcasts, and ever since resmetirom got approval, all about exactly what you raised in the article about the progression. That would have changed the outcomes of some of the trials that were failures because they were looking at different endpoints. That lack of progression for me and the patients that I deal with and the people with poor liver health is and has been really key. And I think it was certainly the patient advocates raised it very highly. Wayne Erskine Ridge, who has cirrhosis, isn't eligible for the medication and would have loved something for non-progression. All of that certainly hit home when I was reading through. And the other one you were just saying about the optimization of cardiovascular disease and the other diseases when we come to treat. If we look at that conversely, for all of those patients undergoing current metabolic studies in diabetes, cardiovascular disease, they've not been optimized for the liver health because we don't really assess it. Is there an argument to optimize those patients to locate the ones with the poor liver health that actually can prevent the outcomes in their studies? And that we should, now that we have better NITs, both biochemically and non-invasively, really playing to our strengths and optimizing the location of disease in these patients, cardiovascular and metabolic?
Louise, I think that's a really important point because, as Sven said in the opening piece, a lot of these patients aren't necessarily fully optimized. And, you know, you can look geographically and sort of methods of recruitment and how the trials are advertised. But what you find is that a lot of these patients, you might consider in the real world, by the time they've got to a hepatologist who may have done a biopsy, one would hope, I don't think it's real yet, but one would hope that a lot of these patients will be on the best possible combination of medicines for their diabetes, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you conduct the trial in a setting where you only have extremely well-controlled patients, the likelihood of seeing the activity may be less. And that goes back to Jörn's point around the screen failure rate and actually getting the trial recruited and over the line in the first place. On the other hand, what we would really like to know when we're thinking about whether or not the medicine works is not whether it works in a whole load of people who have not been well controlled, and actually simpler other medicines might have reduced their risk of disease development in the first place. But actually what we want to know is whether it's going to have a delta over that. And that's where I think First of all, the trials that are currently being more liberal in terms of their inclusion criteria start to sound a lot more attractive in terms of which medicines are allowed. Of course, the challenge then is if your medicine is one of those drugs that is potentially good at optimizing cardiovascular risk, then you're in a sticky situation. If, for example, you have got a GLP-1 receptor agonist within your experimental arm, then it's going to be very challenging to say, well, we're going to allow a whole load of people on a GLP-1 receptor agonist. Some trials are doing that, but then you're really asking about the delta over that. So we're in a very difficult situation where, if you like, normal or placebo has changed during the lifetime of some of the trials that we're talking about. I think that's really important. And, you know, one could take this argument in a couple of ways. I'd like to know what the impact or what, how much we can tell by looking at the placebo response rate around this factor. Because again, that's very variable. In the trials where the medicines haven't got over the line, you tend to see higher response rates in the placebo arm. And I think that is probably a good bellwether as to who's gone into the trial in the first place. So I think you're absolutely right. Optimizing and getting people over the line in terms of their CVD risk factors may alter the, if you like, the baseline, the protoplasm for the trial drug itself.
First of all, I think that's a great point. Second, we talked with Dean Tai last fall, who told us, and I think they showed this at ASLD, actually, a paper that Stephen Harrison delivered, that when they use some of their models, they tend to find a pretty consistent 33% placebo response rate, which is higher than reported in trials. Now, they also show much higher drug response rate. In the case of the resmetirom data, they were showing the drug response was 55, higher than reported also. But Dean said they can pretty consistently get a 33% response rate for placebo, which says to me that if we understood how to look at the underlying issues, we might get a higher number, but we'd get a consistent number, which would be hugely helpful. And beyond that, well, I like your idea that goes, we might be able to learn from the nature of the placebo group. If in fact they're all on the same other agents, then in fact that might become some kind of index in a way that we haven't quite thought of it so far. At least I haven't heard it spoken of so far.
And now back to Roger.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. If you have any questions or comments about the content of this conversation or the entire episode, please put them in the review section of the page from which you downloaded this conversation, or send an email to questions@surfingmash.com. Next week, we will preview Global Fatty Liver Day from the Global Liver Institute, which will fall on June 13th. We'll have several patient advocates and at least one physician champion with us. Until then, stay safe, surf on, say a prayer for our departed colleague, Stephen, and his family, and we'll see you next week on the podcast. Bye-bye now.